In the words of Barack Obama, he's just a jackass.
That was after the Taylor Swift thing, right?
I like Kanye's music. This is completely separate from, like, Kanye as an artist. But he is a jackass.
Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. As we've discussed on this podcast, the current national environment poses big challenges for Republicans. According to our latest polling averages, President Trump is down by 10 percentage points nationally and behind in every swing state. If the current environment sticks, Democrats have several paths to winning the Senate. So what would it take for Republicans to turn things around? Today, we're going to discuss some possible strategies Trump and Republicans could pursue to improve their competitiveness this fall. And here with me to do that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Galen.
Also here with us is Senior Politics Writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hi, Galen.
And also with us is Senior Politics Writer Perry Bacon Jr. Hey, Perry.
Hi, Galen.
All right, let's begin with how the GOP could turn its electoral fortunes around. There are still 4 months left until the election, and certainly time for the environment to change. So let's think of this as something of an open brainstorming session where we can consider strategies suggested by politicians and commentators or just ideas that you all come up with and try to assess how much of a difference they could actually make between now and election day. I'm going to kick things off with one suggestion that's been batted around quite a bit. Not sure how serious it is. These kinds of rumors often float around when a president is seeking re-election. But this idea is replacing Vice President Mike Pence on the ticket, particularly with a woman. So, Perry, let's start with you. What is the electoral rationale for such a move? And is it based in evidence?
So the political science data we have very limited samples, obviously, suggests that vice presidential candidates don't really change the results very much. There's some evidence that maybe the vice presidential candidate has 2 to 3 points in their home state, but that's it. So that's pretty limited. So overall, VP candidates, we're not sure if they matter. That said, I do think in this environment, it is worth thinking about what that would say about Donald Trump. The evidence is, for example, in 08, that voters perceive John McCain more negatively the more they learned about Palin's lack of qualifications. So if Donald Trump were to pick a person of color or a woman as his running mate to replace Pence, is there the chance that voters think of him differently, particularly if he paired that change with giving fewer Mount Rushmore-style speeches and more kind of inclusive language? You can imagine a sort of pivot of Donald Trump to be, let's call it, less racially conservative, in which he changes his rhetoric and he also has a running mate who might appeal to more culturally moderate people. I think that's not a bad idea, and I also think Mike Pence is not adding anything right now. So in some ways, this is actually an idea with a lot of pluses and no obvious negatives from my point of view.
Wait, it seems like an obvious negative would be annoying evangelical voters who like Mike Pence, right?
I don't see it that way at all. I think Donald Trump has got the evangelical vote pretty locked down. I think this idea that evangelicals are voting for Pence because he's church-going and quotes things, I don't think that's actually true. I think we're talking about sort of cultural attitudes, and Donald Trump has the same ones, and therefore, I don't think you need Pence for that.
So I think what the VP talk and, you know, sort of like mind games are all about is really about one person, and it's Nikki Haley. And I think that putting Nikki Haley, a woman and a woman of color and the former ambassador to the United Nations, on the ticket would be actually a play for appealing to a demographic that Trump is struggling with, which is suburban women. You're seeing this really even more massive gender gap in some of the current polling than you did in 2016, which is saying something. And so I think the conversation in my book, you know, cutting through the like, ooh, like who could he pick? I mean, it's Nikki Haley. And I think the question is whether or not Trump would want to make a move like that, which is kind of, on the one hand, bold. On the other hand, yikes, it's like the campaign's in scramble mode. But also, I'm not sure Nikki Haley would take that. I think she might. She very well might. She's done, a pretty good job of balancing being a Trump ally with sort of hinting to, you know, to a certain degree that she is also a different kind of more serious Republican.
Yeah, I don't know why she would necessarily take that. Trump is 9 points behind in the polls. if you are his VP, you're going to have three news cycles a week in which you're asked to repudiate or distance yourself from some tweet he sends or some comments he makes. She, in some ways, represents kind of the future forward for the GOP, maybe in a post-Trump era. It's not clear to me that you wouldn't, frankly, rather have him lose if you're her and not be associated with him as you look toward a nominee in 2024 or 2028. I mean, it is kind of almost a classic Sarah Palin game change strategy, right? Where you know you're losing, so you kind of throw a Hail Mary. I don't mean to compare Nikki Haley to Sarah Palin. I think she doesn't have some of the issues that Sarah Palin had, let's put it that way. But she's kind of a fairly bright prospect, and for that very reason, do you want to take that risk now, right? There's also the other angle that I think if Pence is dumped, then you have created enemy in Mike Pence, and Mike Pence might not be happy about that, and Mike Pence might start to, or people loyal to him might start to say stuff to the press, right? While he's still your vice president. I mean, that could be potentially rather interesting as well.
So there are reasons that Nikki Haley might not want this role. But if we step away from Nikki Haley for a second, if there were a change that President Trump could make to the ticket that would potentially annoy Pence allies, but potentially bring in more women voters, would that be a trade-off worth making electorally?
I mean, it depends on what that move is. Like, I don't know if we're going to move into talking about Supreme Court nominations.
That's up next.
Am I making the transition for you? I mean, you could make the appeal to, frankly, like white suburban women in different ways. And I think that way would be through, nominating Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court, assuming that Thomas steps down or one of the older liberal justices dies or decides to step down, which, I don't think many of them are considering stepping down. And I think Thomas doesn't necessarily want to step down either. But you could see, Thomas's wife is quite looped into sort of Republican politics and Trump world. So maybe you could see a scenario in which he's pressured to resign and someone who appeals to women steps in. I also think that that's kind of a Hail Mary pass. I mean, I think that there are other things that the Trump campaign could do before switching the VP and trying to push out a current Supreme Court justice for a woman Supreme Court justice. But if we're talking, throwing gum at the wall, sure.
So I want to fully indulge a potential Supreme Court vacancy in just a second. But wrapping up the vice presidential conversation, I mean, is that trade-off worth it?
Of course it's worth it. And just to come back, if, say, Marco Rubio, Tim Scott, or Nikki Haley is offered the vice presidency, they should take it. Just to be clear, because that is a way to become famous, to become well-known, to be the runner-up next. If Trump puts you on the ticket, if you're Nikki Haley, and wants you to defend the Confederate flag staying up, then Trump is insane. You still shouldn't do that. So I think being the vice president is actually, the nominee is actually generally a good thing, is going to raise your profile. And I guess the trade-off seems sort of obvious to me, if only because I struggle to think of, like, yes, I agree, Pence's staff will leak bad stuff about the president, and that will not be helpful, although I don't know what they're going to say that John Bolton didn't say. But I think the upside is not potentially just white women. I think it might be that if you're trying to get your Hispanic number from, like, 27 to 33, your black number up. I just think that, like, right now, Trump is in a place where there's a bunch of demographic groups across the electorate he's struggling, and I don't think any of those groups are particularly excited about voting for Pence, and maybe any different person. I think there might be some younger white men who might be better than Pence, to be totally honest. I just think the Hail Mary, when you're talking about replacing Pence, is something where I think there's almost a lot of added value and very little negative.
If you presume that, Trump would get a big bounce among women, then of course he should do it. I don't think there's any reason to presume that necessarily, or at least true. That like there wouldn't be trade-offs. Maybe there are some Republicans who are not comfortable with the women of color on the ticket. And so I'm going to sit this out. I'm going to vote for a Constitution Party candidate, right? Or why the hell not? I'll vote for Joe Biden, right? At least he didn't, I don't know. I think it's not obvious that like it would necessarily. And also, you have to assume that for Trump, that nothing happens as smoothly as it should, that the rollout is botched, that the Pence people are more upset than, they're going to be upset anyway, right? that maybe there are some vetting issues with Haley that they didn't catch and aren't prepared to defend, right? Their awkwardness is around having someone currently sitting as the vice president when someone else is the nominee that they haven't really thought through. I mean, so many of these strategies we're going to talk about are things that if you somehow had a perfect textbook Republican candidate, maybe they could pull off, right? But with Trump, they're all higher degree of difficulty.
I'm not sure I entirely agree, Perry, with the idea that if Trump offers you the VP spot, you should take it if you're Marco Rubio or Nikki Haley or whomever. In part because it has to do with like Trump's own peculiarities outside of just, I agree with you, like the vice presidency raises your platform. But Trump also has a problem with being second fiddle or perceiving to have been second fiddle. So, I mean, you can see this with his new sort of obsession with Fauci, putting up Twitter polls to see who do you trust more, Trump or Fauci. You could see someone like Nikki Haley or Rubio, although I think he's a little bit less of like a fresh new face. You could see Trump getting really jealous of the attention that Nikki Haley gets and then either completely suppressing her public appearances or saying weird things or spreading weird rumors, which I'm sorry, that's not out of the realm of possibility in this White House. So if it were a regular situation, I would say, yeah. But I think Trump's own neuroses about attention and fame make it a more complicated calculus for that potential person.
You're saying Nikki Haley could be famous and have Donald Trump criticize her and have some of the media write there's distance between Donald Trump and Nikki Haley? I don't think she would cry about that. I agree with some of what you said, but I think she might be pleased that she's not considered a great ally of him while getting all the attention. Anyway, yeah.
So you've pointed out several flaws in the strategy, but also some areas where it could make sense if it did improve Trump's standing with certain segments of the electorate. Let's move on to another strategy that, Claire, you already mentioned, which is in some ways repeating the 2018 midterms playbook, where a vacancy opens up on the Supreme Court, and that pushes Americans more towards their partisan corners, and people who were thinking of switching sides maybe don't anymore. And so there are some rumors about Republicans lobbying one of the justices to step down in order to set up that opportunity. Is this a strategy that has significant upsides? Is it liable to happen? And who would it improve Trump's odds with?
I think it's a great strategy. Obviously, we should note, I think Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas may want to keep their lifetime jobs in which they have lots of power and decide public policy. So the first thing I think here is like you're seeing these conservatives floating the idea that maybe Alito or maybe Clarence Thomas are ready to move on. I'm not sure that they want to do that. I'm sure they enjoy these jobs. So let's start with there. But let's say that Thomas he's older. He wants to be a team player. He wants to help Trump in some way. So to me, the advantage of like a Supreme Court nomination is that it sort of changes the issues that are being discussed. Right now, we're talking about COVID and racism and protest. And none of those are great terrains for Donald Trump. He's not doing well in that environment. But if this is a Supreme Court vacancy, the media will cover that story a lot. It'll probably take some of the coverage off of COVID. Hopefully not a lot, but some of the coverage off of COVID, some of the coverage off the protest. And Supreme Court nominations are about abortion, about affirmative action, about issues where the parties are pretty well defined and pretty well split. So I think that I'm not sure it'll turn out any more voters for Trump or what have you, but I just think it'd be a much easier summer for Trump if we're debating, you know, whether Supreme Court nominee X, particularly if that person is a woman or a person of color or both, should be on the court than if we're debating if Trump is handling COVID poorly or very poorly.
The thing about that, though, is what makes it tricky. I take all of Perry's points, but then you also, if you look at 2018 in the midterms, I mean, obviously the Kavanaugh hearings were a very singular event in some ways, but it galvanized both sides, right? There was big, you know, there was a lot of excitement on the Democratic side for saying like, well, you know, hell yeah, we're going to turn out now. Like Trump just nominated Brett Kavanaugh, who we think is, you know, the most despicable person on the face of the earth. And vice versa for Republicans, we're happy to have him. But when you look at some of the Senate races or the congressional races, I think you don't have clear results that it was beneficial for the Republicans. And in some ways, people could say it was like, you know, the beginning of an awakening for Democrats saying the Supreme Court stuff matters. It can get our voters riled up. You know, we already kind of have an idea of who the nominees would be from Team Trump. And I think a lot of those people make the liberal base angry. And so you can see that anger is motivation, which we all know is a very powerful thing in politics. So it is, as with all things, not particularly clear cut.
Nate, can you weigh in on this in terms of how big of an impact the Kavanaugh appointment had on the 2018 midterms? Did it actually benefit Republicans?
It's not so clear. I think what it tended to do is push people toward their partisan corners, which doesn't necessarily intrinsically help Republicans. I mean, Republicans lost an enormous number of House seats, obviously. They lost the popular vote for the House by 9 points, right? So you can have things be more polarized if you're losing the House by 9 points, or in Trump's case, losing the popular vote by 9 points, then okay, right? It might change exactly who wins a couple of states at the margin, but like it doesn't put you in a good position overall. I mean, first of all, if you are Alito and Thomas and you're concerned about the legacy of the conservative Supreme Court, you now face a problem where Trump is an underdog to win re-election, and so now you have to kind of hang on for at least another 4 years. You know, you wonder if Ruth Bader Ginsburg wishes if she had retired before the 2016 election, for example. So purely from that standpoint, there's that question of like maintaining a conservative majority on the Supreme Court. But no, I agree with Perry that like this is one of the few things that would become front page news, meaning it would displace COVID and the protests from getting quite as much coverage, and maybe the economy, all three of which are just utterly terrible stories for Trump.
I want to move on and talk about some of the other possible strategies that Republicans could use in order to turn their fortunes around. Today's podcast is brought to you by Shopify. Ready to make the smartest choice for your business? Say hello to Shopify, the global commerce platform that makes selling a breeze. Whether you're starting your online shop, opening your first physical store, or hitting a million orders, Shopify is your growth partner. Sell everywhere with Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system. Turn browsers into buyers with Shopify's best converting checkout, 36% better than other platforms. Effortlessly sell more with Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Did you know Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and supports global brands like Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen? Join millions of successful entrepreneurs across 175 countries backed by Shopify's extensive support and help resources. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Start your success story today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. shopify.com/538. So the next possible strategy that we can discuss seems like the strategy that Trump is actually trying to deploy given his speech at Mount Rushmore over the weekend. And that is to put more emphasis on a culture war, particularly over the nation's monuments and the role of historical figures. Does that seem like a playbook that could work at this point?
Like an anti-PC culture wars message?
Well, that and also create this dynamic where I'm standing for the historical importance of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, and the Democrats want to tear down the Jefferson Memorial.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a strategy or a message that gets you new voters. That, you know, I think we were talking earlier, you know, Trump is slipping with suburban women. He could potentially, you know, make an outreach to, you know, some groups that like parts of sort of like the anti-PC messaging, but I'm not sure that his lines in the speech this weekend were about the indoctrination of children in this certain ideology, this rigid totalitarian ideology. I'm not sure that those ideas are the kind that broaden your appeal. They certainly do good things for your base or Trump's base, and I think that's what they're meant to do. I think there are ways to have a conversation about the quote-unquote culture wars that are less divisive or less inflammatory than what Trump is doing. And those, I actually think you do have potential inroads with with voters who feel, yeah, maybe alienated by the way that some Democrats, high-profile Democrats, talk about race and culture in America. But I think the way he does it, the way it comes off, is so dark, is so sort of apocalyptic seeming, is so, you know, talking about Nazis and, you know, and authoritarianism. It is quite extreme. And if you're talking about, you know, statues, right, taking down Confederate statues in particular, recent polling shows that Americans are coming around to the idea that maybe some of these Confederate statues, yes, should be taken down. So when Trump makes a whole speech around saying we got to get rid of them, that's a bit of a problem.
So I think right now this strategy does not look like it's working. Right now the polls show the American people are with the protesters. They support BLM more than ever. They're in this moment where the electorate appears to have changed its views to some extent on racial issues in a way that's against Trump and to some extent with the Democrats. Now, that dynamic I think could change, though, and I would say this in two ways. The first is that Trump right now is running against Joe Biden, and Adam Serr, this great piece in The Atlantic this last week, saying, you know, like Trump ran in 16 against Hillary Clinton and to some extent Barack Obama, and those people were very easy to sort of label as sort of part of a changing culture you don't like. Joe Biden's much harder to hit on that. But I think Keisha Bottoms, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Susan Rice, or Stacey Abrams might make it a little easier for Trump to like find a good target who sort of resonates with people, who sort of symbolizes what they don't like. And I mean, we're talking about race, we're talking about gender, and I think if he gets a better target, that might help him out a little bit. And the second thing I think is really hard for Trump right now, but could change, is right now his poll numbers are so bad that you can tell the media is much more comfortable describing him with the R word than they were 3 years ago or 4 years ago. Racist, racially tinged, racism, racism. Like, he's being covered in a way he doesn't sound that much different, I would argue, than he did 2 years ago, but his poll numbers are freeing up people who were nervous about calling him that stuff before to say it much more bluntly. If he goes up back to the 40s and looks like he might win re-election again, I don't know how that would happen, but I think if the economy gets better, if he kind of calms down a little bit in terms of his comments, I do think there's room if he gets more popular overall and the media stops describing everything he does in the bluntest terms possible, then that might help him along as well. Because the culture war can't be won if everything you do in the culture war, nobody wants to vote for somebody who's called racist. And if the media keeps calling everything he does racist, which I think in many cases is true, that's going to make it harder for him to make this kind of case.
But I don't think that terminology, that description by the media of Trump is going away even if his poll numbers rise, Perry. I think that it'll continue in part because the media is largely white and college educated, and you see a lot of white college educated Americans. I mean, the phrase that's thrown around is like the great awakening of these like particular demographics of white America, liberal leaning, college educated. And I think that's what the media is. And I think that there is a movement within the media to use that more blunt language. And even if Trump's poll numbers go up, I do think that it's a bit more of a cultural strain in newspapers and magazines now to talk that way about Trump. I don't know, even if his poll numbers go up like 10 or 12% or something and it becomes a super competitive race, I still think that people are going to be using those descriptors.
I mean, there's also been a lot of reckoning in the media over the diversity in newsrooms, how issues around race are covered. This has affected every newsroom, including 538s. So I think that's also part of this. But like, look, I do think there's been a change. I do think it's notable, like Perry said, that the media is now more willing to use terms like racist instead of racially charged, that a speech like the Mount Rushmore speech, which in certain ways is trying to toe a line between maybe using implication, not saying things quite outright, you know, you can read it different ways. It's now not being read in a way that's favorable for Trump. At the same time, you have Trump this morning, for example, tweeting about the NASCAR driver who was in his garage, the black NASCAR driver, which is kind of a novelty, and how there was something that looked like a noose found in his garage, and all the NASCAR drivers were very supportive of him, right? And Trump is now tweeting about how that's a hoax and how NASCAR screwed up by trying to ban the Confederate flag from being displayed at its races. That is pretty openly, in very crude terms, invoking race it's not as though Trump is carefully triangulating and calibrating stuff. I guess he's mad that, like, there is this black driver who has been very courageous in some ways that kind of Southern white people are supporting now. I mean, that must drive him crazy or something. You know what I mean? But to pretend that, like, there's any type of, like, discipline here and any type of ability for him to follow through with the strategy, which isn't just his kind of impulses, which may be toward, you know, I guess it's not up to me to judge what he believes inside. Certainly the manifestations of what Trump says and does a lot of times are things that I would call racist. It's not like you're even talking about someone like Nixon, who is able to kind of keep the subtext and kind of know what he's doing. And he may believe some very nasty things inside as well, Nixon, but like he was a better arbitrator of political strategy, I guess.
Let me ask one thing to Nate and Claire and Galen too. I raised the idea that this campaign, the way Trump is running now, would be helpful to him if Biden picked a black woman as the running mate. Do you all agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it gives Trump is like a reactive politician. He can bounce off of a new person in a different way. And obviously, like, having a person of color on the ticket is going to be off-putting to a certain segment of people, some of whom might be leaning towards Biden right now, but could be easily persuaded to go back to Trump. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, also, given the current dynamic, you imagine that Republicans try to hammer home the message that this person is the president kind of lying in wait. Biden's a transitional figure. He's going to rely heavily on whoever the vice president is. The vice president might run in 4 years. I think Republicans will probably say that openly, especially if they think the vice presidential candidate is less popular than Biden. So it sounds like what you're saying is that there are certain situations in which culture war appeals definitely do work to politicians' favor, but that you don't believe Trump can execute this well regardless.
Yeah, I think Trump should STFU about the culture war stuff, right? It's almost like a reverse Midas touch, where like positions that might once have seemed extreme, or like a reverse Overton window on the left, right, now seem more normal because the opposition to them is Trump, and Trump is so disliked that, you know, you kind of normalize actually more extreme positions. You know what I mean? I can imagine that, like, people would have concerns about certain statues or something. I don't think people actually care that much about statues. But you can imagine, like, a more effective Republican would be able to kind of triangulate in certain ways, right? And say, yes, Black Lives Matter, but we also have to preserve our heritage, as complicated as though it might be, right? And these people are going too far. And that would be seen as the reasonable position. But Trump, now that kind of triangulated position, you're like, is this just kind of cover for like a racist position, right? Because, again, a majority of voters in polls think our president is racist. And that was before the George Floyd protest, right? There's polls from a while ago. I'd imagine those numbers have gone up since then. So he has a great deal of trouble kind of actually persuading anyone with his arguments on these issues.
All right. So let's move on. And this maybe dovetails on the argument that you're making, Nate. But the next possible strategy would be somewhat of an overhaul of both economic and COVID-19 related policies. So maybe get really aggressive on combating the coronavirus and pumping stimulus dollars into the economy. Maybe it's unrealistic, but is this a strategy that would improve the Republican Party's lot this fall?
Yes. If Trump governed like a normal Republican would, absolutely, that would help.
It's also the easiest thing to do.
Well,
this is not to say that fighting coronavirus is an easy thing, but it is relatively more simple to, even outside of Trump, just making more structural changes within the White House and the task force and public messaging. These are things well within the grasp, and some might say the expectation that an American public has for its leadership. Just the bare bones.
Yeah, I just think being like a normal president in the middle of this crisis would obviously be helpful to him. Claire said it's easy. I mean, it would be easy for someone other than Donald J. Trump. I agree. But it's like, in reality, I think it's the hardest thing to imagine if we've decided. I think it's much more likely to convince Trump to bump Clarence Thomas off the Supreme Court than it is to get Trump to behave normally amid COVID-19. But I agree, this is by far the most optimal strategy. I do think if I were Mitch McConnell, I would try to get Trump to approve more unemployment benefits. Like, there are things that help the economy that I think Trump may not be against. And in some ways, that actually may be more the Republican Congress may be opposed to some of those things, like extending the increased unemployment benefits may be a place, or like having more relief funds. There's probably a place on the economic stuff where a more populist economic plan might help. And that's a place where my guess is Trump actually might be for that, and the Republicans and McConnell might be against that, and they might in this way be holding him back a tiny bit. I don't know, because I don't really know what Trump's views on policy issues are, and they tend to evolve a lot. But I think there is a place where I think you could see him doing more on the economic front. In terms of like handling COVID better, I think we know that ship has far sailed now.
I guess the inverse of this question is, would any president be doing poorly under these circumstances with COVID-19 and an economy where 11% of Americans are unemployed and there's just a lot of anxiety about what's to come?
I mean, look at Cuomo in New York. New York has had a huge number of deaths. Obviously, the economy is tanked here too. But Cuomo was perceived, and I think was, a visible, proactive leader, and people liked that. Now, hindsight being 2020, we see mistakes, right, were made, particularly with nursing homes. I think that's something that Cuomo is really getting a lot of flack for now. But he was perceived to be a strong and visible leader. I think that there is opportunity in some of the economic stuff to make pathways. And in some ways, that's probably Trump's, like, this were, it's like his 2016 instincts towards populism. But yeah, I think, you know, the short answer is yes, you could have a leader who did well under this.
Well, look, I mean, yeah, I think, first of all, worldwide, there are a lot of leaders who have become more popular because of their response to the coronavirus. In fact, that's been the more common pattern, actually. And of course, most countries have responded better, or at least in ways that seem more reassuring and coherent, right? There's like both the kind of objective fact that the U.S. response has not gone well, and the fact that like there's no coherent message. But look, yeah, if there is some scenario, if we wake up on November 4th and Trump has won re-election, then I would think the most likely reason that is because of a turnaround in the coronavirus numbers or other data related to the coronavirus, right? Where, you know, let's say that the South and the West get through this current phase. One can imagine that by the fall, that it looks like, remember, we could have a second wave or a third wave or whatever in the winter, but that's not relevant for the election, right? It could look by the fall like we've been through the worst of it. The numbers are falling, that the death rate in particular is falling because fewer people in this new kind of cohort of cases seem to be dying, right? And there are some treatments now that further lower risk. There is promising news about vaccines and the economy. Now people start to feel more comfortable. They're coming back a little bit. I mean, there are scenarios you can draw up where that happens. Would Trump get credit for it? I don't know, right? If 150,000 Americans have died, or 170,000, but the numbers are down a lot by November, will he get credit for it? I tend to think not a ton. Especially if it seems like the progress is happening despite him and not because of him. But there is uncertainty in the COVID outlook, and some of those scenarios could benefit Trump.
Even given that, you know, when people talk about presidential elections, oftentimes they focus a lot on the economy. Is it realistic to think that a president could win re-election with 11% unemployment and just the general economic anxiety that's here? Nate, I know you've been doing research into economic data and elections, working on the model right now, and just that data alone looks pretty grim regardless of who the president is, right?
Yeah, I mean, although economic forecasters still do predict a rebound, although it's not clear what assumptions they were making about the coronavirus, right? If you assume that we're through the worst of it by May, then okay, you start to have a rebound that can be more significant by November. Obviously, we were not through the worst of it by May, or at least only half the country was. The other half is having the worst of it now, right? There probably still is time by November, right? If this were August or September, it'd be different. You know, early July, there probably is still time for things to improve significantly by November. But yeah, look, I mean, this is going to be, we looked actually at all elections dating back to 1880, and kind of even under fairly optimistic scenarios, this is going to be one of the four or five worst economies for any president since 1880. And by the way, some of the stimulus money will start to run out. I mean, like Perry said, I think I would want to get as much stimulus money into the hands of as many people as possible if I were Trump or a Republican, right? The fact that Democrats seem fairly willing to do this is like giving you like free ways to curry favor with your constituents. And so if there's some like Republican deficit spending or anti-egalitarian ideology that's preventing that, then that's pure electoral suicide, I think. So yeah, I mean, that would be the first thing I do is say, okay, all the stimulus money that we have, let's extend that for another 3 months, right? While these cases that have not gone down in the South are getting resolved.
We have a few more, maybe more far-fetched strategies to discuss.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
So let's talk about a rather sinister strategy that, to some degree, it seems like the Republican Party could be using, and that is basically mess with the election. So try to implement voting restrictions, ensure that not everyone has the opportunity to vote by mail, which is something that Trump has been very outspoken about already, generally attack institutions potentially. Credible reports have said that President Trump has already asked foreign powers to influence the election. So how realistic of a strategy is this, generally messing with things, to try to win re-election?
It's super realistic. It's already happening. It's going to be a big part of the next 4 months or however long we have to go. I mean, as you laid out, Galen, there are different, very different things that fall under that same, you know, headline. But, you know, the RNC and the Trump campaign, even before, you know, we were going to have a vote by mail pandemic, right, there were already a lot of lawsuits about voting rules. There were already, you know, there was already the desire to hire a lot of people to be poll watchers, which is historically a very racially motivated way of suppressing votes at the poll. So it's a big part of this year's election, in part because of just the uncertain state of how voting will happen in November. We've said it a million times on this podcast. We don't know what the state of COVID-19 will be like in November throughout the country. Although the more we know about the virus, the more we know that it's really bad inside and more people are going to be inside in November. So that throws a lot of uncertainty and into all of this. And I think the idea of Trump for the past 4 years sowing uncertainty into people's minds about the election system and fraud is really damaging. And that kind of has in the obviously the internet era and in the era of you know, fake trolls and bots and all that stuff, there's a lot of fertile ground for people feeling discouraged by the system and therefore not wanting to vote. So that's also an effective way of messing with the system.
The one thing I would say is American elections are run at the state level, not the federal level. And so a lot of the efforts to like make it harder to vote by mail, or in Texas where they're allowing you to vote by mail if you're over 65 but not under 65, which obviously advantages the Republicans. The one thing I think a lot of these things are problematic. I think a lot of them are going to happen. I would say, though, that at the state level, as it becomes more normalized, the idea that Trump is probably going to lose, and if he is down 7 or 8 points, minds as we get near the election and people are talking about what's happened post-Trump, why Trump lost, and so on. I think your incentive, if you're the Secretary of State and you're Republican in Arizona, to kind of do things that are going to maybe help Trump win, but probably won't get him over the line anyway, and are going to be very controversial, get you attacked a lot, and maybe help hurt your career going forward, I think your incentives for that might be going down. Like, I think Trump himself is speaking more about the idea that he might lose and like why that's unfair. And in some ways, he's himself weirdly sort of normalizing the idea that he might lose, which I didn't expect him to do. And so I think if the Republicans in these states who run the election system, I think may have lower incentives to do things that I think are nefarious than they would have if the election is really, really close. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's my only thing that I feel that's maybe different than a few months ago.
Yeah, that's fair. But, you know, and Perry brings up the idea that, not the idea, the fact that our country has, you know, non-centralized elections. So states run elections. And that's good in many ways because, and this is, I'm going to move into a point about hacking in the election. And obviously we know from John Bolton's book that Trump has potentially been soliciting other countries to interfere. The fact that our system is decentralized is good in a lot of ways because you couldn't, quote, like hack the entire election. You couldn't burrow your way into one spot, you know, in an NSA computer or something and throw everything off. But because states are responsible for running their own elections, you find a lot of really disparate cybersecurity means. So Alabama's online voter registration portal might be complete shit, whereas California's is amazing and really technologically tight. By the way, California actually does have a pretty good history of cybersecurity and voting. And this remains a huge problem. I think the Russians got into the back end of something like 16 online voter registration systems in the lead up to 2016. They didn't do anything, but they kind of like let it be known that they were there. So the idea that different states have different systems and the cybersecurity and frankly just like the human error involved with elections. You're supposed to air gap election machines. A lot of states don't necessarily do that in the strictest possible way. So there are still a lot of opportunities for, you know, not to necessarily like change votes, but to disenfranchise people, right? If your name, if your information on your voter registration doesn't match the ID that you present at the polling place, well, you'll probably be given a provisional ballot or, you know, you might not be given the opportunity to vote. And that kind of causes a whole bunch of redounding effects. So that stuff is a real worry that I think is like talked about less this year just because there's lots of stuff happening.
Yeah. I mean, this is a question that we get a lot from listeners who ask about the effects that various ways of messing with the election could affect its result. Nate, I'm curious, do you think that any of the things we've discussed here are serious enough that you would think about it as a possibility for changing the result of the election?
I think it's a really difficult question because there are things that have permanent effects and things that have short-lived effects, right? I mean, look, the fact is that Republicans have generally tried to make it harder for the sorts of people who are less inclined to vote Republican, especially people of color, to vote. And it's back and forth because people want voting to be easy and every governor and every secretary of state is different. Now, look, in the short run, if there is a lot of concern about making it tough for someone to vote, that can motivate people to be more conscientious about making sure that they do have multiple plans to vote. So in the short run, voter suppression may be counteracted by activating voters, right? In the long run, it kind of is different and it can get baked in and be one of the barriers that you just face, that you have to kind of make a plan if you're African-American in a place with crowded precincts to vote, right? It's not as simple as just saying, oh, I'm just going to go to my precinct and maybe I'll have to wait for 20 minutes, but, you know, no big deal, right? So there's like a cumulative effect that I think probably has potentially fairly big effects on the electorate. The marginal effect of any one year is a lot more debatable. And then there, you know, and then there's kind of like not always a fine line between the fact that things are kind of big and obvious, like lines, for example, like the fact that in most states, felons can't vote, and that leads to a huge amount of disenfranchisement of African Americans in some states and other minority groups. Like, these things have pretty big effects, right? But like, if you kind of then go from that to like this notion that, oh, the GOP will steal the election somehow, I mean, that becomes a lot more complicated. And that terminology can kind of substitute for more precise claims that can then be kind of assessed and evaluated. So like the thrust can be right directionally, but then you have to watch the specificity of what you're kind of saying is happening, and you have to kind of distinguish the short run from the long run impact.
A lot to think about there, and this is a topic that I know we're going to come back to over the next 4 months. But I don't want to let this podcast end without bringing up another possibility for helping out Republicans in perhaps turning around their fortunes this fall, and also a hot topic over the weekend, which is a famous third party candidate who may wage a write-in campaign, and whether or not that could have some effects on the election. Of course, I'm referring to Kanye West announcing that he is going to run for president. I know that as members of the media, we should be careful about how much legitimacy we even give to this announcement. So we have saved it for last, but before we do go, I do want to hear your thoughts on how this could affect the election this fall.
So 2018 poll from YouGov, they just put this online just now. 69% of Democrats have an unfavorable view of Kanye West. 13% had a favorable view. 53% of independents had an unfavorable view of Kanye West. 13% had a favorable view. Among Republicans, 34% favorable, 42% unfavorable. So this is worth thinking about there. A lot of the coverage will assume Kanye West is black, hence black vote. But it might be worth thinking about, does Kanye West have more appeal to Republicans than to black people and therefore Democrats?
I mean, I'm not laughing at Perry. It's good that we have the polling numbers on it. I mean, I think I'm a little bit of the attitude of like, I can't believe we're talking about Kanye West. Like, someone texted a group chat I'm on this weekend, which was like, and they were like, oh my gosh, is Kanye actually running for president? And I just did not reply. And that's kind of how I feel in general. Love Kanye's music. Ultralight Beam and The Life of Pablo was like the soundtrack to the 2016 primaries in my head. But he is in no way a serious candidate. But congrats to him for continuing to be, I don't know, relevant. Like, I don't think Gen Z likes Kanye at all. I mean, they're out here calling Beyonce mom, so I don't know what they think about Kanye. I don't know. Maybe Kris Jenner also has a hand in this. Like, I could spin some PR conspiracy theories about that. But, like, is Keeping Up for the Kardashians up for, like, a new season? Does he have an album? Like, to me, those are the most obvious answers here. They're not electoral.
Yeah, he also faces logistical challenges in that the ballot deadline for independents has passed in a handful of states with quite a few electoral votes between them. It will soon pass in a number of other states if you don't get a lot of signatures very quickly, right? So it's not so easy to just kind of run for president, right? That means something. You know, he's not filed any statement of candidacy with the Federal Elections Commission, as far as we're aware, as of Monday early afternoon. So I don't know. I guess I'm kind of like,
what about a write-in campaign, Nate?
Galen, you are there's so much bait here. Yeah, I don't really think it matters very much. And also there are perceptions, okay, like, oh, he'll take away black voters, right? Like, look at, there is polling, like we've been citing, on like, when people think of Kanye West as a politician, who he appeals to, and he's a pretty outspoken Trump supporter, right? So like, I don't know. I don't even know, to the extent people have to have these stupid hot takes on a holiday weekend, right? Like, I don't know why the hot take is, well, he'll take the black vote from Biden, right? I mean, why wouldn't he take, like, I'm not sure how to put this.
Oh, now I'm excited.
The votes of white people who want to demonstrate that...
Well, the token is...
they don't think Trump is racist, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a vote that maybe... People are like, you know, I don't really like Trump, but I want someone who kind of shakes up the system. And it's just not at all obvious to me, kind of, if he got 1% of the vote or 2% of the vote as a write-in, it's not at all obvious to me kind of where that would come from necessarily, right? Because it's not like all the support for Biden, it's not like there's a huge amount of enthusiasm for Biden anyway, right? It's that like people understand that like if you don't want Trump, and there's a lot of enthusiasm against Trump, right? That Biden is the best way to facilitate that. I don't know. I think people might still get that.
I guess the one thing that I want to say, Galen, before we close is, I gather that Kanye has decided that Trump is too racist to support. Is that what we should, like, this, what does this tell us about Kanye's politics? Because, I mean, not, maybe we don't care about Kanye's politics, but is, if there is a small number of black Republicans who have been with Trump these last 4 years, and I've been writing about this a little bit, I do wonder if maybe these last 6 weeks are going to show Trump going from like 10% of black people to like 6%. If this was like, if Kanye can't be with Trump anymore, who can be with Trump? Maybe I'm giving Kanye's political views too much seriousness, but I do wonder if this is a sign that very few black people want to appear in public with Trump in the future. Even people who used to like him, maybe he's went over the line in the last 3 weeks.
I think that's true. I mean, I say this seriously. I think it's also just a reflection of like Kanye's family was embarrassed by his Trump support. That was pretty clear in a lot of ways. Like,
you mean like his family? You mean like Kim, or you mean like his,
like his wife? What do you mean by it? Kim Kardashian, okay. I think, and the family seemed, while she has obviously worked with Trump, I think they were, I believe they hosted some sort of Hillary Clinton fundraiser. They at very least donated. I assume that there are some family conversations happening in the background. And yes, I'm sure like the George Floyd stuff riled Kanye up. But I do think he's like, if we're taking Kanye's politics seriously, which like everyone, I don't know, people are idiosyncratic and we should take people's politics seriously. Because whatever, I don't know. Kanye's kind of like in this weird space between contrarianism and kind of like woo-woo spirituality when it comes to politics. So I think it's more just like egotism.
Fair enough. I have to admit also, I had one more thing on the list of things that Republicans could do to turn their lot around. And it was Trump's resignation. And I understand that I don't think anybody thinks that's realistic. But would it turn Republicans' lot around?
That's a whole podcast.
I don't think Pence would. I have been disparaging of Pence repeatedly in this podcast, and I would say if the candidate is Pence, I don't think that helps a lot. But it probably helps. But I mean, I do think right now Trump is, and the way he's behaving is like very suboptimal. The way he's talking about the Confederate flag, the way he, like his approach to COVID and race is problematic in a way that I don't think Mike Pence would approximate. I think like a Nikki Haley would obviously be better. So yes, if the Republicans could like get him off the ticket and get somebody normal in there, it's hard for me to imagine a sort of normal Republican would be down 10. Maybe they're down 7. So I think that's right. But I mean, the civil war in the Republican Party that it would take to get Trump off the ticket maybe means that I am going to backtrack a little bit and say maybe that's not worth it. But I do think a normal candidate would be better than Trump right now. Is that controversial even?
It could be because, yeah, I mean, now you, okay. I mean, like you're saying, maybe now his base is dispirited and like everyone else is like, okay, right, right. I want to turn to Trump. Well, I might as well go with the other party. I mean, I think in part because Biden is this kind of generic Democrat, right? The way that might work is if, let's say the nominee were someone more left, right? Let's say it was Warren or Sanders, and there were a lot of voters. I think Warren or Sanders would be way ahead, like Biden is, frankly, right? But there might be a lot of voters who are like, you know what? This is a bridge too far for me, but Trump has been so bad that like I'm going to have to vote for Bernie Sanders, even though I'm kind of a center-right, you know, whatever, lawyer or something. You know, I think those people might be thrilled to vote for a Pence or a Haley, right? But I think if the alternative is Biden, she'd be like, you know what? Republicans kind of screwed this up so badly. I'm just going to vote for Biden anyway. He's kind of a centrist that I can trust. And then vote Republican for Congress, maybe.
So a Trump resignation, you're saying, would not necessarily help Republicans. It would dampen the enthusiasm among his base.
I mean, it's like it increases the Hail Mary. It might help them a little bit in Congress.
All right. Well, is that a good place for us to leave this blue sky brainstorm session of how Republicans can turn their fortunes around for the fall?
Sure.
Anyone have any other wild, crazy ideas they want to proffer before we close?
I mean, I guess the only thing to think about is the alternative is, does Biden screw up somehow?
Or illness.
And I don't see the scenario, because I think he's running a good kind of in the basement has become a cliche, and he actually does a lot of speeches. But I think he's, but I think the question is, like, is there something Biden could do wrong? And I'm not sure the answer to the question, but that's a sort of alternative theory, right, how they can catch up.
I guess that's not also something that Republicans can control.
Right, that's true.
But, I mean, they can control how they try to shape the public's view of him, which is maybe something that we didn't talk about here as a strategy, but is, like, maybe change their attack ad plans. I don't know if there's anything they could do that could get them 10 points, but anyway, I think that's a good place to leave it. So thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Perry.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.